Good morning. My name is Jure Moore. I'm the president of the Minnesota Groundwater Association. I'm also a senior hydrogeologist and project manager at Barr Engineering in Duluth. And I'd like to welcome you to the MGWA 2022 Fall Conference. Thanks for joining us today for what is our first in-person meeting in 3 years. How amazing is that? Awesome to see you all. And it just so happens that 2022 is also the 40th anniversary of MGWA, so we're excited to celebrate that milestone with you here today. We're happy you're here today to learn more about Minnesota mining and water resources and to earn continuing education credits while raising money for MGWA efforts through your registration fee. You'll also have additional opportunities to contribute to the MGWA Foundation Student Scholarship Fund today, and I'll provide more details about that shortly. We are very grateful for your continued support of MGWA through COVID-related uncertainties and now as we transition back into in-person events. So before we begin our talks this morning, I'll start with just a few logistical details about the meeting today. First of all, in case of an emergency that requires leaving the building, the primary exits are the doors that you came in. There's also an exit on the side over here. Restrooms and charging stations are located in the hallway near the reception desk area. And the agenda for the day, presentation summaries and speaker biographies, and a survey to provide feedback at the end of today's meeting are in your registration packet. If you do misplace your copies, there are additional copies available at the registration desk. Our presentations today are scheduled to run for 30 minutes with 10 minutes at the end for questions. And I do encourage you to ask questions. It's a highlight for our speakers. If you have a question, please raise your hand and wait for one of our roving microphone helpers to come and bring you a microphone. This is important so that the speaker can hear the question and everyone in the audience can hear it as well. And I will note that the audio from today's presentations will be recorded and will be available on the MGWA website after the meeting. We'll start the talk shortly. There'll be a 15-minute morning break at 9:30. Lunch will be from noon to 1, and then there'll be a 15-minute afternoon break at 2:30. Beverages will be available all day out in the reception area, and snacks will be available during the breaks. And then lunch will be served in Carriage Hall B, which is the room right next door. So the technical program will run until about 4 o'clock today. And then following that program, we hope you'll join us next door again in Carriage Hall B for appetizers, beverages, and social time to celebrate MGWA's 40th anniversary. And you'll find a drink ticket in your behind your name badge. One drink ticket is included, and you can purchase additional beverages, and those proceeds do go to the MGWA Scholarship Fund. In addition, when you enter the social hour, there'll be MGWA 40th anniversary pint glasses, and one per person is included. You can purchase additional pint glasses if you're interested. And so as I mentioned earlier, you'll have multiple opportunities today to contribute to a great cause, the MGWA Foundation Student Scholarship Fund. So if you're interested in contributing, look for this bulletin board. It'll be out near the reception desk area, and you can make a donation. And as an added incentive, anyone who contributes will be entered into a drawing to win a handmade wooden charcuterie board in the shape of Minnesota, which is right. Five prizes. Oh, so your odds are good. So before we dive into our talks, I'll just say a few words on today's conference theme, Minnesota Mining and Water Resources, and today's agenda. Mining of industrial and metallic minerals contributes significantly to Minnesota's economy, and large mineral reserves position the state to continue to play a key role in meeting future global demand. Mining activities have had a significant influence on Minnesota's landscape. Given the key role that water resources play in our state's identity and economy, it is important to apply a rigorous and scientific approach to understand, predict, and manage the potential impacts from ongoing and potential future mining activities. As you'll hear about in more detail in today's presentations, this presents complex challenges that lie at the intersection of science, engineering, and public policy. While I certainly must acknowledge some bias because much of my work in recent years has focused in the mining areas, I'm really excited to hear today's presentations, which will give us a window into how these challenges are being navigated. Even if your work is not in the mining space, I think anyone with an interest in the state's water resources will find today's presentations to be interesting and relevant. Our first presentation this morning will be an overview of mining activities across Minnesota, which will provide context for the presentations that follow. Following the overview, the presentations delve into a wide range of topics, starting with characterization of groundwater flow and fractured bedrock, followed by the use of groundwater and surface water modeling to assess potential impacts from a proposed mine. We'll then hear about DNR's mining hydrology program with some case studies. And our final presentation before lunch today will move away a bit from the mining theme, but will allow the team that prepared the recently published MGWA white paper on the Groundwater Protection Act an opportunity to present their work. After lunch, we will hear about research to characterize the geochemistry and microbial communities in deep bedrock groundwater. And then our final set of presentations today will highlight some of the key regulatory issues and challenges associated with mining, work being done to evaluate the fate and transport of sulfate in the environment, and emerging research to evaluate potential approaches for sulfate treatment. So, with that overview of the day, I'd like to go ahead and introduce our first speaker today. It's Ted Anderson from Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, who will provide an overview of Minnesota's mining.
All right. Okay. That's coming through. Just a couple things before, this is just the home slide. I got a couple names on here. Mine and a mining engineer, is that really loud? Good? Okay. Another mining engineer, GIS expert that we have up in Hibbing, Tim Pastigo, who helped me put this together. A couple of things we learned during COVID is we learned how to get really good on virtual meetings. And one of the things, maps often tell a big story. And so what we're going to try today is a little bit of an interactive GIS exercise on maps so we can, for a lot of you visual learners, really hone in and see where things are in the state. But first, I just want to tell you about lands and minerals within the DNR. It's a small division with the DNR, basically represent the public lands and mineral activities in the state. Less than 100 staff. Minerals office is up in Hibbing, kind of the hub for northern Minnesota. We have engineers and scientists in the permitting and research group. And then we have engineers and scientists, namely geologists and mining engineers, in the exploration, leasing, and revenue verification. And that's the group I'm with. And so we represent the state lands, the state mineral lands. In just a couple facts I want to give you, since 1890, about $850 million in revenues have been generated on state lands, about half of it in the last 10 years. So we represent the school trust, which is K through 12 education for every student in the state. Right now there's about 850,000 students, K through 12. The school trust has about $1.6 billion in its corpus. About 80% of that came from mining activities since the late 1800s. And that works out to about $50 per student. Now this is a trust, and this is a trust so that's just the interest. That's going on for perpetuity unless some legislative action happens. That's what we have funded for our K through 12 students going forward forever. We also manage the university trust lands, which is a much smaller acreage, but really strategic on the Mesabi Range, and we'll get into that a little bit more. Just want to get these dollars in front. That's about $600 million in their endowment. It's the largest endowment for the University of Minnesota. It also does a lot of the research activities up at Natural Resources Research Institute in Duluth, the Coleraine Minerals Research Lab in Coleraine, and a lot of scholarships throughout the state. We also represent the mineral interests on tax forfeit lands, where the counties would handle the surface. The DNR minerals handles the mineral interests on tax forfeit lands. And just over the last 10 years, about $40 million has went back to the local communities, and that's in the ratios with the local school district, the county itself, and the township. And some of these activities can be a real boon for the township. There's other lands too, but what I'm getting at, all these public lands are used to operate at a strength, to negotiate by either rule, statute, or rules that give us opportunities to negotiate to get the best fair value for the state of Minnesota, so that if there are revenues, that we are capturing the right revenues for the state. So as I mentioned, today's presentation is going to be mostly a GIS activity, and we're going to look at the 130-year history of iron ore, the new exploration and mining projects, included Minnesota's unique watersheds, and I'm going to go forward, and I can drop this notepad. Okay, now I'm going to be going back and forth from PowerPoint to Adobe PDF, and what you see here is North America, and you'll see the watersheds through here, but let me go into the more detail. I'm going to figure out how to do it. Okay. So right now, this is North America. You can see the background on the PowerPoint. The background will show basically these blue areas, and there's a legend here, but the red and the blue and the yellow, they're all different features on this map, but I'm going to try to be flashing them for you. And we're going to look at just some major watersheds. So for example, the Hudson Bay, which kind of boundaries on the Mesabi Range in northern Minnesota, and we'll dive down deeper into Minnesota. Another one we selected here too is the Great Basin. This, unlike other basins, is one where everything goes in, nothing goes out. So we thought that was interesting too for this map. But here are the watersheds, and I'll be blinking those a little bit. You notice in Minnesota that there are three different watersheds. You got the Lake Superior over here in northeast Minnesota, the Gulf of Mexico, Mississippi, and the Hudson Bay that flows north, or Rainy River as we call it. And that's because there are three unique triple divide points in North America. And one is right around north of Hibbing, Minnesota. The Hill of Three Waters, we call it. There's also one, I believe that's Montana. I don't have the state lines, but just from geography, I believe that's Montana, western Montana. And also one, British Columbia, maybe. So that's it. Now, with that in mind, I just want to show you North American mining activity too. I know we talked about Minnesota, but in Mexico, that's the mines that Mexico has, right there. And then if you go to Canada, that's the Canadian mines. And then if you go to the United States, much less for the proportion, but a lot of it still is up here in Minnesota. Now we've heard the term also critical minerals. Critical minerals, federal government is very very in tune with those. There's been a lot of government bonding, infrastructure bonding for critical minerals. And where are the opportunities in North America? And they are right here also. Some in Minnesota specifically. Manganese, nickel, there is some lithium potential as well in Minnesota. So I want to dive in a little deeper to Minnesota, though. That's why we're all here. So I'm going to skip the PowerPoint. That didn't seem to bring anything. So we'll just go back into the Minnesota. And here, a little more detail zoomed in on the three-way divide. And now we're going to go through what is actually happening in our state. Well, let's look at the iron formations. We talked about 1890, 1888 actually is the date. But where are these iron formations? These iron formations are here. And when I was asked to do this presentation, just a little aside, I was really happy when they talked about the history of mining in Minnesota, because I've never got to do a presentation before that I didn't talk about the southeastern Fillmore District. And I'm going to today. So if you look here, Minnesota has a history of iron ore mining, and that is a fact, and it's still going strong. you have three distinct ranges that we've always talked about. You have the Vermilion range up by Ely, up here. And yes, there will be one more zoom in, so we'll get a better detail later. But you got the Vermilion range up here, Tower, Ely area. If you've ever been to the Sudan Mine Underground Park, that's part of the Virginia or the Vermilion Iron Formation. High-grade hard rock mining. You got the Mesabi range that has been active since the 1880s and is still continuing strong today, over 100 miles expanding with a horn in the middle, and we'll get to that in a little more detail. But you also have the Cuyuna range, named after a man named Kyler and his dog Una. They found this Cuyuna range in the Crosby-Ironton area, and that was going strong until the 1970s. High manganese iron ore. And then in the 1940s through the late 1960s, there's this other mining district in high-grade iron ore pods that mostly went to the blast furnaces in St. Louis of high-grade iron ore that was mined in this area of Fillmore County. Now, it was mined for over 20 years. It was a soft iron ore. It was done with mostly bulldozers and trucks and little backhoes. They hauled over 9 million tons over those 22 years. Just to put that in perspective, there's a couple operations who do that in 1 year on the Taconite Range right now. So that is the iron formations in Minnesota. Now, I'll leave those up for a little bit, but I want to look at now the Duluth Complex and the greenstone belts of Minnesota. Duluth Complex, we've heard those with Twin Metals, Teck, Polymet, even Talon is part of that Duluth Metals complex. And also the greenstones, which we've had lots of exploration, a lot of times is attributed with gold. A couple explorers there, Anglo Gold did some exploration there. I'm going to miss a few because there's been multiple. Vermilion Gold still has leases. And that greenstone belt goes all the way over to western Minnesota. What you notice here, why did I do that? What you notice here, there is a mine up in Canada, right across the river in Emo, Fort Francis area, that is also part of that greenstone complex. Now, we always make a joke about gold deposits or mineral deposits don't know anything about political boundaries between Canada and U.S., and that is true. But I will say much of the reason why there's more activity here in northeastern Minnesota and why there isn't, disregard Duluth Complex greenstone, high mineral potential. The only difference is the way the glaciers came across, you were looking at zero to, you know, basically, if you've ever been to the Northeast, it's mostly rocky outcroppings, but you're looking at less than 100 feet of surface. When you get over here, and sometimes in these prairie areas, you're looking at over 1,000 feet of glacial till on top of bedrock. That's usually a sign that maybe we'll wait. That's expensive mining. So basically the cutoff is about 300 feet. If you have 300 feet of glacial till, maybe you're going to think about it some more before you really start exploring. So now put that in perspective. I showed where the greenstone belts are, the Duluth Complex, the iron ore ranges, and now we're going to go at historical mineral leasing. And what we're doing here is I'm just putting up the facts. This is what we carry in our GIS. GIS is a great tool. It's more than just a map. It is a database that can track a bunch of information. But here's historical mineral leasing, and you can see lots of leasing between the Duluth Complex, that extends far to the south, included in here the brown of the peatlands and the Sac-Zim Bog up by Floodwood. You got all the Mesabi Range, the Cuyuna Range. A lot of this is the greenstone exploration. We got a lot of exploration in far north Minnesota, right across the river from the new gold mine up in Canada. And so that's historical mineral leasing. Now, the way the state works is in order to do exploration, you got to get a mineral lease. mineral lease, a lot of times they will go with state lands. They're usually the where the companies will go to first. We do publish, we're very transparent. You can get a mineral lease. There is another route you can go, and you can go to be an exploration on a sampling permit or an exploration license. However, it's much quicker turnaround, and you do have to share data. So for a company wanting to develop a project, spend lots of money exploring, mineral lease traditionally is the way to go. Now, I got these numbered to be helpful. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, here's our, this is what we have on record. Now, when a company wants to explore, and that could be in the form of a sampling permit, that could be in the form of a test pit, most often, the best form is a type of drilling. Now, they can get inexpensive from reverse circulation drilling to bedrock. They could be hard cold core diamond drilling. It's just a cost of what they plan to do. But I will say drilling is the most expensive, the most serious of exploration. And this is where we have record of exploration in the state. The Yellow Duluth Complex, the blue again, in the same places where the leases were. So these companies that explored, leased the land, explored the land. Now we're going to put that layer on again, that mines in the USA. And you will see that mining USA map on the larger scale was not that dense. However, in Minnesota, we have a lot of opportunities, some in the UP of Michigan as well. So what you see, the big cluster of red is the taconite operations that are active right now. This one right on the lake, that is actually the loadout and plant facility for North Shore Mining, which is idled right now for business reasons. You also have these peat operations, many of them in the swampy areas up north. And that's our current mining activity. And much of that does benefit the state trust that we represent. There's also some mines in Canada. And then this one is a layer two. I want to also say that if I flash this, this is aggregate resources throughout the state. They're all over the state. And we do have a hand in that. That is usually with the surface interest. So in that case, tax forfeit would be done by the county, but that's a technicality. But aggregate resources are very strategic throughout the state for infrastructure. And there's a lot of, there's a lot that the DNR does get involved with. Okay, now let's zoom in a little further. Let's go to northeast Minnesota, because that's where the activity is. That's where the Mesabi Range, Vermilion Range, meets the Duluth Complex and the Greenstones. You know, actually, there is one lease that we have with a taconite lease for the first 400 feet, and anything below it is non-ferrous. It's never been acted. It hasn't been developed that deep, but there is a meeting of these two complexes. So here you can see, this is the Eastern Mesabi Range. This is Duluth. 1, 2, 3, 1. So we pop back on. Here is the historical mining leases. Again, a lot of them right on the boundaries, right in the edges. The Greenstone Belts, where the surface is shallow. And also here in the Duluth Complex in the Mesabi Range. Okay, that's the active state mineral leases right now. I'm just going to try to flash this so we can see it. So again, Mesabi Range, Duluth Complex, Greenstone Belts. Okay, now I'm going to take that off because my map is getting too cluttered. And here again is the diamond drill hole exploration. Again, same places where the leases were. So those are the facts about where mineral activity has happened in the state. I do want to know, if I zoom back out to here, a lot of state interests in here in northern Minnesota. I did want to talk about a little bit. See, when the state was formed back in the mid-1800s, you know, I believe it was President Lincoln, said every section 16 and every section 36 should go to the state for the purposes of funding education. I don't know if kindergarten through 12 was the purpose at that time, but it was. So any sale of those lands went into that corpus we talked about, that $1.6 billion. At the time, Minnesota was a new state. Much of the lands in southern Minnesota were primarily agricultural lands, and they were sold. I'm sure the prices were high, but they were sold. The lands in northern Minnesota were not as attractive, and so they weren't. And then when iron ore was discovered in 1888, the state decided no more are they going to sell these mineral lands, and that has went on since then. So we do not sell mineral lands anymore, but rather retain them for future value for a long time. So that is primarily what I wanted to show you today. I'd like some feedback. I'd love to hear some questions. Anything I could answer. Was it on the North America? Okay. Let me go back to the PDF. And he said southern Iowa, northern Missouri.
Yeah, when you click the button that shows lines for the United States.
Are you talking about those blue mines that come up there?
Yeah.
You know, I'll be taking a guess at this, but there were Missouri iron ore mines at Pilot Knob. That would be my guess. But I don't even know what region. But Missouri did have a very high quality magnetite deposit underground for a while. That Hanna Ore Mining, which was a really heavy Minnesota company, did manage for a while. That'd be my guess, but I don't know.
Yeah, I'd add there's also active very large lead zinc mines in Missouri.
Okay.
Thanks, Ted. That was a great. It's a very cool format to just have a talk and look at maps. As a geologist, I love that. If you could, please talk a little bit more about the Fillmore Iron District and what the geology of that is.
Yeah, the geology, and I really did my studying a day ago. I wish somebody would write a book about this because it just fascinated me. I mean, it's carbonates, and they feel like, and there are papers out there where there's like five different opinions on how this iron formation formed. What they do know, it is newer than the traditional Biwabic iron formation. It is a newer type of ore. It is mostly gaetite and some hematite, direct shipping ore. But it was mined in pods where the carbonates were gone and they filled up with iron. And I am not a geologist, and I'm going to get in trouble if I keep talking, but how many geologists are in here? I was going to open with a geology joke, but I'm glad I didn't. No, but I would love somebody to write a book, and I will buy the first copy because it just fascinated me for so long. We don't talk about it. Yet it was a major player in the 1940s or 1960s for just that. And it's right across from the Galena District in Wisconsin, where the lead mining, you know, you heard the Wisconsin Badgers. Well, the Badger is, that was a lead miner back in the day. So, fascinating history, but I don't know much.
I could add something. Kelvin Alexander, who's a retired professor, geology professor at the University of Minnesota, recently did publish a little bit on the origin of those Fillmore bog iron deposits. And in a nutshell, he thinks they form from precipitation out of iron-rich groundwater that had an upward gradient and reached the land surface and oxygenated and precipitated the iron.
Thank you.
That's Kelvin's idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You mentioned something about 400 feet of taconite on top of the Duluth complex. Is that at the northeast end of the range in the Duncan Pit area, or?
It's in the northeast part of the range, and I could be misquoting. It could be 280 feet. I don't know, but they have one lease on top of another on the same 40-acre parcel. And that is in the northeast area, close to where North Shore is, former LTV. I don't know if it's right in the Duncan or not, but it's in that vicinity. Sure.
I just have a comment about the Southern Iowa mines. I'm an amateur paleontologist, as half of us are. But down there, it's Devonian and Permian, the Carboniferous, and used to go in those old coal mines, surface coal, low-grade coal.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they're stripped out now, but they make great spots if you want to look find some neat club mosses and such like that.
Nice.
Mining, sorry. Yeah, I'm not from Minnesota originally, and I'm just curious, how many more decades, based on the current extraction rates, assuming economics aren't going to change greatly, are thought to be possible for iron mining?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I mean, that is a we've revolutionized how we mine. I mean, the direct shipping ores were gone. We thought we were going to be done. Dr. Davis developed the Davis tube testing, the taconite, the magnetic separation process. And we've gotten how many more years, 60 plus years out of it. Right now, we have we just did two leases with scram operators, which is basically a recycle operation of what they used to throw away. And they're trying to do those, high intensity magnets now are able to take not just the magnetite, but the hematite, the gaetite, the siderite out. With the high intensity magnets, different types of heavy media flotation. It's all a process, and can you do it cheaply? But it's no secret that right now we have a couple companies moving dumps. We called them dumps back then. They're moving dumps and putting them back north of the iron formation because back in the 1970s thought, no way will we ever mine that. Now every mine has a stripping ratio of 1-to-1, and it could be the cutoff rate changes as you advance your technology. And, the drilling is expensive when you go deep, but there is no running out of the iron formation. It just hasn't been explored. A lot of people think that the Mesabi Range to the Cuyuna is one intact range. However, it just gets really deep. But as far, to answer your question as well as I can right now, there are three companies that have 40 years plus of reserves. It's been said over 100 years left, but that's at today's technology.
Sorry.
I don't know why I'm listening to the...
Is there any iron left in the gunflint?
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I'm sure there is. I am sure there is. I mean, there are still places you can go out back and find the old direct shipping ore in smaller quantities. So any iron, yes, I'm sure. But.
What's the geology joke?
Oh, boy.
Not going there.
I'm not going there.
My question is, you touched on how, there's a large focus on critical minerals now, renewed interest in manganese, renewed interest in, things like nickel, of course. I was wondering about rare earth elements and whether there's any mineral potential in Minnesota for rare earths. I am a geologist, so I should probably know this, but I just don't know, and I have to believe with the DNR's core library that there's just a ton of rock in that library that's been assayed for, very targeted metals, without, you know, anything in mind with respect to some of these lighter rare earths that have a lot of interest now.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, we didn't even talk about the core library in Hibbing, but, you know, we have rules in place by very interested legislators that made it a rule for any exploration outside of a permit, and any on state land especially, a quarter core of any exploration has to be offered back to the state to retain it for exactly what you just asked. And that is good. And discoveries have been made in that from old core that were reevaluated later. And that's, you know, that's how some of the platinum palladium was found in the Duluth complex. It was looked only for copper nickel. And it looked at it 10, 20 years later, and sure enough, platinum palladium were there and made that kind of a game changer for the potential of that industry. Now, I have heard out in western Minnesota in some of the, where I showed you where that bedrock to surface is really deep, there has been some rare earth potential over there, I know, in discussions. I'm going to ask that question when I get back. And if I could get your name, I'd like to answer that question because it is a good question. There has been rare earth potential.
Thanks for the great presentation. So November is Native American Heritage Month, and I was just curious if any of that money in the coffers for educational purposes is going to any of the downstream communities, Native American communities in particular, for educational resources.
Yeah, I wish I knew how to answer that question intelligently. I just don't. I know it has been discussed, but that's a good point. And I don't even know if I have the right answer. So, but I'd like to answer that one for you if I can.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you may know what the status is of the manganese deposit just north of Crosby-Ironton. Is there anything happening with that?
Well, I know there's a company called North Star Manganese that has started talking about a project in the Emily District. They've done a couple presentations for the city of Emily, and they have made a request for negotiated leases with the state. Now, nothing has happened. I have talked to them, or we have talked to them. No action has taken place, and any lease involving that does have to go in front of executive council, so which is the governor, the lieutenant governor, secretary of state, auditor, and I'm blanking right now, but there's five of them that they have to approve any leases, and they have requested for leases. No defined project has been submitted, no permitting, and what they're asking for is leases to be able to explore a little further on the properties.
Okay. Well, thanks for all the great questions. We should move on to our next speaker here.
Sounds good.